the future. Let me try my people come.
Hey, everybody, welcome. Yes, it is a Monday. Yes, back here with a little Out to Coop Live. Yeah, we've been absent for a bit, you know, since we had a little bit of a break. Work stuff piled up and everything like that. But tonight, yeah, we're going to ease our way back in. It is Monday, April 1st, 2024. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop Live. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. And Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right for Rome, backyards, and across the country. And tonight, I am proud to and very excited to announce a new direction in the show. Been doing a lot of kind of like thinking about, you know, my work and my job and all this kind of stuff. And is realizing, you know, I really want to get out of my job, right? The money is just not here in, say, progressive media to do this, but there's a ton of money on the right. So as of today, well, not today, we'll give you one last shot. But as of the end of this week, we are going to completely be switching formats and we are going to become a right-wing Christian nationalist radio show. We got a big chunk of money coming in from all sorts of funders. We got some more interest from, you know, the very people that we've been kind of critiquing over the past couple of years. Well, they've decided to kind of jump right in and fund it. So I get to quit my job, live a good life, and, you know, screw it. You know, the world's burning down anyways. So nobody gives a crap anyway. So I figured might as well cash in on it, and we're going to jump in there. Yes, it is April Fool's Night, everybody. Yes, I know I'm a very bad April Fool's person. I know I'm not convincing, but I just thought I'd, you know, whatever, just for the shits and giggles, as it were, get in on there, everybody. Never, never. Well, you can also join us at the end of the week for our Friday Politics Roundup. We break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. You can get all of our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. And you can support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Head on over to patreon.com/rcpress for all the details. You can also help out the show by heading over to our YouTube channel if you're not there already. Smash that subscribe button, like the stream for this show, and hit that notification bell so you know every time that we go live. If you're one of our awesome podcast listeners, make sure to leave us a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen on. And leave a comment to let other folks know why you like the show. Little things like this help other people find the show. For more progressive talk, tune in to the Rick Smith Show's live stream, 9 p.m. Eastern, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, wherever. Get it and subscribe to his podcast, wherever you get your podcast. Check out the ricksmithshow.com for the latest across all his platforms. And the Sisters of the Night Caucus is another podcast to check out. The amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast. Rock the house! And you know where the bodies are buried. Make sure to follow them on Twitter at the Night Caucus. That's at the Night Caucus on Twitter. And subscribe to their podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Check them out. And The Signal, the flagship podcast from the Bucks County Beacon. The Signal is hosted by the Beacon's editor-in-chief, Cyril Michaleko, and produced by yours truly. Twice a month, The Signal will shine a light on right-wing extremist currents streaming through Bucks County and beyond. Cyril invites guests who can provide insight, analysis, and organizing solutions so that we can steer the community toward calmer, saner, progressive roots. Check them out at thebuckscountybeacon.podbean.com. Latest episode just dropped this past week. And The Civic Circle is another podcast of the Bucks County Beacon. They tackle politics and policy from a Gen Z lens. Sarah Zhang, Mallory Marzen, and Alexandra Coffey are students from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And once a month, they chat about activism, advocacy, and all the political happenings affecting their generation today. Check it out at civiccircle.podbean.com. And attention all you gamers out there, The Game Inn, that's with two N's. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they've got everything from retro N64s, latest consoles, video games for all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, walls of Funko Pops. And kids get discounts with every A on their report card. Check them out on their Facebook page and follow them on Twitter at The Game Inn. That's with two N's. Got a question about a game, look for something hard to get, shoot them a message or drop them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com. And if you find yourself in the Kutztown area, well, you got to check out the Heart and Hearth Deli and Smokehouse. That is located at 466 West Main Street, kitty corner from Kutztown University's campus. The Heart and Hearth is an American bistro featuring barbecue and French-inspired fare. Mwah. All with locally sourced and organic ingredients. You check them out at heartandhearthcuisine.com or check them out on their Instagram at heartandhearthdeli. They're fantastic. Say hello to Colleen and Jim while you're there. Colleen is awesome. Jim is awesome. And the food is spectacular. The place is cozy and inviting. You got to check it out. Well, everybody, what can I say? Here we are. It's another Monday. And what do we got for you tonight? Well, you know, I got a bunch of stuff for you tonight. So, you know, if you tuned in to this past Friday's show, I got a little allergies or cold or something going on here. But if you tuned into the Friday show, is like, you know, part of what I talked about for a good chunk of the show on Friday was this article from the New York Times that had just dropped called like Why School Absences Have Exploded Almost Everywhere. And it's basically looking at the pandemic and, you know, there's these absences that are kind of cropping up in schools, which seems to be a very real thing from all the data. But my concern was like more about the narrative around what we do with this, right? And potential like problems with the way that kind of narrative is being told. Like so much of this was so much of the discussion in that article in the New York Times was about, you know, learning loss. Right, was about the kind of learning loss and learning loss and learning loss and learning loss and absenteeism leads to learning loss. And now we've already have much of learning loss. And, you know, I've always had a real problem with that term for reasons I talked about on Friday. I'll say it very briefly here is that if you're measuring the term learning loss, right? First, I mean, think, you say learning and loss. Right. So that means there's this thing that has been lost. Right. That thing is learning. There's been a loss of learning. Right. And so that begs a couple questions. Right. So what exactly have students lost? Right. Means they had it and they lost it. Right. And then secondly, how are you measuring this? Right. Like, so if you're lost, you have a benchmark where you're saying this would be like the amount of learning that should be, and then there's a loss of it, right? So it begs the question of what that barometer is, like what that line is that you're measuring from. What kind of yardstick are you using, so to speak? And the problem for me has been the yardstick that they were measuring learning from didn't change before and after COVID, right? So in other words, you have this pandemic that kills more than 1 million people in the United States alone. It is an unprecedented, unprecedented event. People lost family members, jobs, careers, trajectories. All sorts of things happened. Anxiety went through the roof. Mental health issues went through. I mean, all this kind of stuff happened, right? And so we come back to school, right? Once it becomes, you know, to get into all the debates around, you know, coming back to school and in person and masking and online and all that kind of stuff, that all takes place. And come back to schools. And now it's like the push to normality, right? The push to normality to say we need to get students back up to these measures. Right. And so they said students, now they were out of school from 2020 and 2021. Let's just say that you did somewhere less, somewhere more. Let's just say they're out for 2 years. Right. Year and a half even. Right. So let's just say 2 years, just for the ease of the discussion. And so they're out for 2 years. Right. And so you came in. Right. You were a sixth grader at the beginning of the, you know, in 2019. And then you were just about to leave sixth grade in 2020 when everything got shut down. March 13th, 2020. I remember it. It was a Friday the 13th, March 13th, 2020. As the death toll started popping up, right? Things started shutting down. And so you're a sixth grader, right? You don't get to kind of like, you know, graduate, like, or, you know, go through the regular end of the year ceremonies, right? You start middle school as an online student, a school that you've never attended before. You start there, right? And then maybe the following year, you do half the year in person. Maybe you do some hybrid stuff. Maybe you go for the whole year, but things are not the same, right? But now you're that eighth grade at the end of that seventh grade, right? So you come in, say, the end of the sixth grade, you're into the seventh, like seventh grade gets all shut down, and you come back in eighth. I get that right? Sixth grade, seventh, eighth, yep. The eighth. And now as an eighth grader, getting ready to go to high school. And then so these people, you know, these test measurers, these standardized test people, these policymakers, they go in and they go get their yardsticks from pre-pandemic and they go, and they dust them off and they stack them up and they kind of line students up next to those yardsticks and say, oh man, look at that. You've got learning loss. This is the yardstick of learning and you're shorter than you should be. So you've got learning loss. And it makes sense to do that as long as you are going to be completely okay with not treating teachers and students and your society like human beings. If you're treating them like a production line, as a cog in a machine, then you want to get back up to production and maintain profitability, right? You just got to hit that again because somehow that yardstick for eighth grade is the natural yardstick. And I'm here to say that's a bunch of crap. Before the pandemic, there was rich critique of the way that we deal with this kind of assessment garbage and this standardized testing in education. And it was a failure then. And then to come and take a failed system and then use that to measure educational outcomes, as the nomenclature goes, to measure those educational outcomes based upon a failed measurement, a failed yardstick, is inhumane. There was, of course, there's a lot of discussion and consternation and kind of anxiety about like the increase in mental health concerns, about the increase in kind of learning disabilities and the increase in absenteeism, as the New York Times article said, right? But maybe very little was said, at least in these mainstream sources, about maybe this belief that we just need to get back to normal and dust off the old yardsticks to standardized test them and get them back on the production line. Maybe that was causing some of the anxiety. Maybe all the articles that were out there about kind of how your kids are failing caused more anxiety for parents, for students, for the kids themselves. And maybe when those kids went back to school, and they were supposed to pretend like everything was normal again when their lives had just been turned upside down and teachers were being told to pretend as if things are normal again. No wonder so many teachers left. No wonder so many medical professionals left, right? I mean, you go back in and then you're going to bring out the old yard so you'd measure it up and you'd have to pretend that you just didn't go through a trauma. I mean, it seemed to me to be the most obvious. And yet, you bring it up to people, and they're like, oh, it's learning loss. What are you talking about? It's insane, right? Hey, here's just an example. Before the show tonight, I was just going through. I said, you know, I want to look at this. Please tell me I left this up here. Oh, my God. So this is just, I just did a Google search on this, right? And I just did learning loss in schools critique. So listen, these are headlines, right, for the past few years. The startling evidence our learning loss is in. Who's left out of the learning loss debate? The reality of COVID-19 learning loss due to school closure during the COVID-19. Parents don't understand how far behind their kids are. New research finds a pandemic learning loss impacted schools. 4 years later, children are still struggling for the pandemic. Too much focus on learning loss. It was the one article, too much focus on learning loss. A historic mistake. But then back to it. Why should parents of school care about learning loss? COVID learning loss has been a global disaster. From The Economist. Children are facing potentially permanent learning loss. Ah! I mean, it's not funny, right? But it's like, what do all those headlines have in common? Right? They're about a crisis. They're about a crisis of a thing that is being labeled learning loss. And it seems to me that it is a completely misplaced, or I should say, it is the wrong place to focus our trauma, right? To focus what had happened during COVID. It is a place that is prepared to blame teachers, to blame administrators, to blame kids, to blame parents about their failures, about politics, whatever. It's all about how everybody effed up. And now you've got a whole generation of kids that are screwed up. That's what that narrative is about. And it's devastating to me. It's devastating because it is a failure on the part of people in this country to reckon with a real pandemic and its aftermath, real sense of loss, of disruption. We're so afraid of grieving what happened that we have to go on and fix a made-up problem or a problem that was designed, a measurement that was designed to measure something that didn't work to begin with. Like, we had been on this train of, like, you know, again, I've told this story on this show before, but I'm going to tell it again right now, because my mom was a kindergarten teacher in the kind of like the center, you know, center city, inner city Utica schools where I grew up in Utica, right? She worked with a lot of poor kids. She worked up for kids who had poverty was rampant. Like, my city was like no glorious place. My mom worked with those kids in kindergarten, and she loved it. And her approach and her strength was always, hey, these are human beings, right? I'm going to, like, these kids are, like, are curious and interested, and they need just somebody to, like, pay attention to them, right? They need a place where they can get us a good meal. They need to place consistency in their life because poverty has wrecked good portions of our city. Right? And just that, like every other story we tell about kind of inner cities, not only we're talking about real poverty, right? But concentration of African-American kids, of Black kids in the schools, concentration of first-generation immigrants. Because that's how our country deals with people, right? We take a brutal economic system and then we inject it with like high doses of racism and anti-immigrant stuff and pull yourself up by your bootstrap nonsense. And we shove them into the worst places in our cities, in our rural areas, and then we defund everything around them and then we blame them for it, right? I mean, that's how our system works. But there's always in those schools, those teachers, man, they worked their butts off. My mom loved working with those kids. She would come home exhausted, but she loved working with those kids. She got moved for, you know, again, because schools move around, all this kind of stuff. So she got moved to a different school right around the time that they were ramping up all the standardized testing nonsense. Right when we were being told, no child left behind. We know how that story went, right? We know how that story went. That story went, no child left behind, but then we're going to use this policy to shut down schools and hand it over to privateers. We were going to claim we're trying to help the least among us, but really we're using it as a kind of a bait and switch to hand over against those we have the most among us. Right? So here we are. She gets moved over to this other school. Standardized testing regime comes in. And she finds about 2/3 of the way through the year, she's told she's got to get rid of her lesson plans. That she can't do that anymore. That, you know, what are you doing with this, like, this painting exercise that you're doing here? Like, why are kids doing that? They don't you know we have tests coming up? We have standardized tests coming up. And our schools, if we don't, these kids don't do good on those tests, they're going to pull our funding for our schools. They might shut us down. Where will those kids be then? You got to train them for the tests. So she was supposed to be teaching kindergartners about how to fill in bubbles on sheets. And they had no freaking clue what they're doing. Why? Because 5-year-olds don't get standardized testing, multiple choice exams. It's completely counterintuitive to everything about their world. It is developmentally inappropriate. But there they were. Totally do that. And this, you know, so, you know, again, she's a teacher. She's like, they slowly bring it in. And then after a few years, she couldn't take it anymore. And she retired early. She would come home from school wrecked. They're not, she described because she couldn't believe what was happening. She was finding out she's going to those kids that she loved teaching, and she's hating her job because she knows she's doing things that are not valuable for the kids. They're valuable for some bureaucrat or for some private entity who's publishing those standardized tests and selling them to districts and to politicians so that they can discipline, punish schools and kids and teachers. I mean, it's unconscionable in my mind. And it's also unconscionable to me that you've got parents so worked up about this that you've even got some parents who believe that that crap matters in life. And look, I there's a difference between recognizing the reality of the way standardized tests are used, right? And versus saying like, oh, my kid does great on these tests and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to give all this blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Oh, my kid is special. My kid is wonderful because they got all these standardized tests and look at how they follow the rules and fill in the bubbles, right? But that's rare. Most parents are just full of anxiety about this because they're worried that if their kid doesn't do good on their test, right? It's one, it's going to reflect on their kid. Two, it's going to reflect on them. Three, it's going to limit their opportunities in the future. Because parents know those tests are not being used to help out the schools. They know they're used to judge their kids, to judge the teachers, to judge them. Look at even our language around it. If you do, I mean, I can't tell you about, you know, even in this horrific experience we've had in the Pembridge School District, right? Of right-wing takeover, right? This kind of like fever dream of several years, right? Even some of the arguments that were made by parents who were most concerned about the direction of the school district, they would even use the discourse of test scores, right? Look at our test scores. Our test scores are not doing good since you've done this. I'm like, and look, I didn't jump into it at this time because we had a task, right? We had a task to get rid of the crazies. We had to get rid of the Moms for Liberty people who were kind of just ready to kind of wholesale destroy our public school system, right? That was the number one task. I'm all aboard the coalition to get that accomplished. Right? Let's got to get it done. But holy crap, why on earth would we kind of jump in and use test scores as the measure? The worst part about that is it reinforces an elitism in our society, right? All those people who are so anxious about their kids going to the best colleges, the best thing and all this stuff, and they believe that the path through there is through these test scores and standardized tests and like all this kind of, you know, that whole thing that parents are trained to freak out about, or their kids aren't going to get into a decent college, right? Those people who are kind of like, you know, the type A personalities who just are willing, they want their kids to be elite and they think that they're already special and their kids are going to be elite, goddammit. Excuse me. They're worried about the test scores because of the way that'll affect the AP exam, the way that'll kind of go into the standardized test, and so their admission to college, right? And there is a pathway for a very limited number of people to kind of go through there and show that they're great. But you know what? All the research shows that all that does is reinforce the existing inequities in our system. I know this will piss some people off, but you know what? It's like, it's great. So I wasn't going to lead with this. I was going to come back with it, but there's this article that's come out. This came out, let's give it 2023, right? So this came out, you know, last year, right? It's called The Real Learning Lost, A Lost Opportunity to Reimagine Schooling, right? By Kirsten Robbins and Kristen Cipollone. Right, from Ball State University. I'm just going to read the abstract for you now. If I had more time, we can get into the rest of the article. Here it is. Reflections on pandemic schooling and its aftermath have been dominated by narratives of loss. Most notably, there had been a sustained attention given to students' loss of learning and loss of social skills, with implications that this will lead to loss of revenue and a lost generation down the road, as I led with. This neoliberal view of schooling, which is steeped in whiteness, has led to a narrow understanding of both these problems and their solutions. The solutions that are suggested, informed by whiteness and dominant culture, have significant consequences for all children, but especially BIPOC kids. Specifically, there has been calls to focus on classroom efforts on raising testing scores and calls for adding the teaching of social-emotional learning skills. In this paper, we critique these moves and argue instead for a more expansive view of possibilities for schooling post-pandemic. Rather than framing this loss as a reason to focus on test scores and scripted curricula, we encourage educators to consider what children have gained and how we might reimagine more democratic, just, and liberatory schooling as a result. We highlight two pedagogical frameworks, community-engaged teaching and restorative justice, as viable alternatives to focus on academic learning loss and SEL, social-emotional learning. I'm like, boom. So if my work life didn't go crazy this past week, these are the folks that I'm still planning on doing this, but going to find a different night to do this. These are the folks I want to have on the show. I want to have these two on the show, or at least one of them on the show, to talk about this article and to talk about what they're finding in this research. Because I felt like, yes, right? I'm like, these are my people. Thank you for, because, you know, it's like, you know, you start talking about this stuff, start talking about, like, you know, the problem of focus on testing in this learning loss narrative. And like most people really seriously just look at me like I'm like a nut job. Or look at me like, what are you talking about? Right? Or there's always once in a while you get these looks that I know what they are. It's like, oh, their kid must not be doing so well in school. Right? Right? Whatever. You know, it's like, dude, she's whatever. I got people's faces in my brain right now as I say that. But it's like, this is not it. I mean, you know, in so many ways, what's happening in this learning loss narrative that we're so committed to as a society, one that is so focused on failure, and a willful refusal to deal with the consequences of the entire experience of COVID and just kind of bring dust off that yardstick and set it back up is just, it's insane to me. It shows me, it's another mirror that I hold back up. I say, holy crap, not mirror's the wrong word. It is another piece of evidence about how far we've lost our way. And I want to go back to the reason why I decided I was going to come back to this tonight, right? Because this has been bothering me for a long time. I mean, you've heard me mention this on the show for a while, like several times over the past couple of years, but you know, it's not the kind of thing that I've really just fleshed out. In part because there's like so much other crap going on, you know, it's like, seriously. But here's a perfect example. This is an article from this past Wednesday. And I don't think I've even mentioned this on the show on Friday because I was just still kind of chewing on it at that point. This article in The Guardian about Estonia. Okay. Estonia schools. And here's the title or the headline: Free Lunches, Brain Breaks, and Happy Teachers. Why Estonia has the best schools in Europe. Followed by, how did a small, relatively poor country become an educational powerhouse? Creativity, autonomy, and a deep embrace of the digital age. The journalist is Amin Sanar, Amin Saner. Right. And I wanna read a little bit from this article, and I apologize to be reading at you, but just to give you a sense of like how I'm just thinking about this, some of the things that are coming up as I'm reading this. So I'm just going to read right. So I'll take the first couple paragraphs and I'll skip down somewhere. So today's subject, this is the beginning of the essay or beginning of the article. In today's subject in the sci-fi class at Pelgulina State Gymnasium is Blade Runner. Thursdays are, quote, voluntary lesson days, where students at this upper secondary school in Estonia's capital, Tallinn, can choose from a range of subjects. Others taking place today include the Rights and Democracy course, a programming and creative writing in English, a bunch of other ones. The 7 17-year-old students in the sci-fi lesson have just finished watching 30 minutes of the film and are preparing to discuss it when I sneak in at the back. Switching to perfect English for my benefit. Quote, we've talked about Jungian archetypes, persona, and the superego, says Trin, one of the students. Quote, it has been really helpful for me to understand the different aspects of being human and how to create deeper characters, unquote. They've also studied Brave New World and 2001, A Space Odyssey. And in the few minutes I am there, the students touch on U.S. history, child labor, empathy, and more. Quote, I have so many questions, unquote, says Trin. Me too. How did Estonia, a small country that is relatively poor compared with most of the EU, become an educational powerhouse? In the Organizations for Economic Cooperation and Development's Program for International Student Assessment Rankings, which measures 15-year-olds' abilities in math, reading, and science, the top spots are held by a handful of Asian countries. But Estonia ranks next, the best in Europe. Its teachers are highly educated. The focus is on social and personal skills as much as academic learning, and the typical curriculum is packed with a wide range of subjects from robotics to music and arts. British politicians are taking note. In 2022, Labour's shadow education secretary, Bridget Phillipson, visited to see what Estonia is doing right. Right. Skip down a little bit. One of the abiding principles, she says, is this is, I'm sorry, this is, this is Gundra Tyer. Who leads the International Assessments for Estonia's Education and Youth Board. She says, one of the abiding principles, she says, is equality. Universal free school lunches are as much ideological as they are practical. And almost all children attend kindergarten, which is heavily subsidized, so that by the time they start school at the comparatively late age of 7, disadvantages are not as entrenched. Autonomy is also fundamental. Quote, we have given schools the ability to decide for themselves, unquote. When Estonia embraced the digital age, schools were part of that. As far back as 1997, the country launched an initiative called Tiger Leap, to upgrade computer resources and provide internet access to schools. Quote, We trained a lot of teachers, connected all the schools, and gave them computers, unquote, says Tier. Quote, the idea is not to have an IT class, but to have digital skills incorporated everywhere, unquote. Many children learn coding and robotics, and everywhere from textbooks and everything from textbooks to communication with parents is digital. Instead of disrupting students facing harsh disciplines, says Tier, Estonian schools tend to have a more nurturing approach. It is common to take children out and teach them in a small group with a separate teacher, and most schools have a psychologist and a counselor. Creative subjects are just as valued, Tier explains. Quote, they all have to take arts and music and what we call technology. In other words, they learn how to cook, knit, things like that. If we allow kids that, their well-being and sense of accomplishment increases. We don't think that's irrelevant. Some countries say, we took out the music lesson to teach more maths. But look at a sheet of music and you will not think it is less complicated, unquote. Creative subjects, Tier points out, can foster all kinds of skills such as teamwork and problem solving. She smiles when she remembers watching teenage boys at a large festival last year enthusiastically taking part in folk dances they'd learned in school. Quote, it's a physical activity, gives you joy, and you are in a group and you have to use communication skills, unquote. Right? I mean, it's the same kind of stuff we see. I've talked about this on the show before. We saw what we see in Finland, right? The same kind of stuff they do in Finland. It's a very different approach to education. It's not this kind of ram everything in a very narrow focus. Let me see if I can skip down another part here that I wanted to. Here's another one. In Maria Toom's class of 10 and 11-year-olds, some of the children have stayed back to speak to me, all in excellent English. What do they remember of kindergarten? It was fun, they say. Quote, we had sleep breaks, said one girl, Laura. Here they get brain breaks instead, she says, several times in a lesson. Their teacher, known by her first name, will give them a break for a bit of movement or to play a game. Quote, one of the key elements of the Estonian education system is that schools and teachers have a lot of freedom, says Salem. There are standards they need to meet, but how they achieve that is up to them. Toom has access to tablets and laptops for the children, but she's just as likely to take a lesson outside or on the roof terrace with a paper and pencil. Not to study nature, although they do that too, but because it's nice to learn math outdoors. I think it gives freedom and it means that students have the flexibility to learn everywhere. A little bit down further, the teachers use a mix of practices, says Agnes Kosk, head of languages, who was leading the sci-fi class. Quote, this generation wants to express their opinion. They want to be included in the conversation, to know all sides of the issues. Teaching by regurgitating a textbook doesn't work anymore, unquote, she says. She says a good relationship with her students, quote, is number one. If you don't click with the students, it doesn't matter what you do. Estonia's education system seems particularly geared up to nurturing that from the informal and creative approach to mostly happy teachers. In her sci-fi class, there is clearly a great relationship. The students have created their own hashtag written on the board, which translates as Agnes Cool. Kosk asked them what notes they made when they watched the first part of Blade Runner, and this sparks a discussion about whether or not they'd fail an empathy test, which would mark them out as one of the film's non-human replicants. What does it mean to be human? And a bit about the film's history. Is this, one of the students asked, one of the first films to have flying cars in it? Unquote. Time to watch some more. Lights down. The students fix their attention on the screen. It comes out there. Okay, so now look. There are things in here that I didn't write, right? Or that I didn't read, right? Things like this. It said, like, this is not a utopia, right? This is not like the perfect school and all this stuff. But the approach is kind of what matters here, right? The idea that teachers are respected, that teachers are well educated, that teachers are given the autonomy, right? To really try to find things that works is just amazing. The fact that you have Estonia, which is not a wealthy country, that you have Estonia that has decided that as a society, with their not unfound riches like we have in this country, but what they're going to do as a society is invest in this kind of education. One that is going to approach kids. Yes, it's going to be rigorous. Yes, they're going to have like standards that are out there, but this whole idea that standards are only these really specific things, this really regimented regurgitation that you get on a standardized test, that's not what they're doing. And it bothers the hell out of me. Right? You know, my daughter said tonight, you know, she said, you know, I don't understand why we don't have, why they're getting rid of like free lunches in schools. Why? You know, and it goes back to that paragraph that I read early on from this article, right? It says, one of the abiding principles is equality. Universal free school lunches are as much ideological as they are practical, right? That idea, the reason why you have free lunch at school is because you want to take that out of the equation. You don't want food to be another marker of division and difference. Right? You don't want, you know, you never forget like Paul Ryan. Remember Paul Ryan? Paul Ryan out there saying that basically, you know, what are these kids on these free lunch programs, right? Because their mom didn't care enough about them to make lunch for them. I mean, come on. Try to interpret getting a school lunch as a parent's lack of love for their kids. I mean, are you kidding me? And right now, the Republicans are trying to propose laws that would make it illegal to have universal free lunch. I mean, it's like the idea that at all costs, we must keep division. And the Democrats are just as bad, except they do it a little bit different way, right? They do it through means testing. Right. Even like Shapiro's argument, like right now, or thinking like, we're going to have like, you know, like we're going to limit the tuition at a higher education to like $1,000 a year for a certain select group of people, like with parents who make less than $125,000. Right. Why? Got to keep that division. Right. And there's a real positive part about that. Right. I mean, there's a real positive part about that saying, look, we recognize the people who struggle the most, both with loan debt. Right, who have lack of opportunity, right? Who've been already victimized by this the cruel culture that we live in. That we should make sure that we target our efforts there. To at least give them a hand up, right? To at least basically say we want to give you a fighting chance in this brutal Hunger Games system we've got going for us. We want to at least give you a hand up. But it presumes the inequality. It presumes inequality. It presumes that you are going to say deserving and undeserving. It presumes, as I've said on this program multiple times, that you and your neighbor may be on the same page or may be at odds. Depending on where you fall on that little line, you might pay full tuition or you might pay $1,000 a year. There's a reason why programs like Social Security and Medicare are the most supported, welcomed, and successful programs, social programs in this country. Why? Because they are universal. Because they are based, to quote Estonia educational leaders, on equality. Social Security is based on the premise that you are old and you will no longer need to work. And you should, after giving your life working in this country, you should not be thrown on the trash heap. You shouldn't be forced to eat cat food to survive. We take care of older people because we take care of our grandparents, right? The same principle. people love to use this word like family in this country, right? Oh, it was one big American family. Okay. Well, that means you take care of people. You take care of your kids. And you take care of your elder, right? I mean, you do that. If some of your kids were starving, you'd be horrified. You make sure that everyone's fed. I mean, that's a principle of equality. Medicare, same thing, right? You retire, you don't have to worry about you don't have to worry about the private health insurance fleecing you every day. You don't have to worry about kind of like endless like co-pays and trying to figure out if you're able to go to your doctor or not. No, you get it. Even they try to get rid of that. And there's a reason why Republicans want to destroy Social Security. There's a reason why Republicans want to destroy Medicare. It's because of that equality principle. And there's those people that are who fetishize the meritocracy who also want to keep that inequality. So that they can say, look how great we are. I guess you didn't try hard enough. We got where we are because we worked hard. We got where we are because we are the smart ones. You go on that kind of stuff. That's just another form of divisiveness. Now, I'm not saying everybody's the same. I'm not saying that there aren't some people that excel in certain things, don't other. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying as a cultural ethic, this country thrives on division, divisiveness, and inequality at its core. Injected, I mean, again, inequality of race, inequality of gender, inequality of economic opportunity. And we fetishize it, even when we don't want to admit it. The school lunch program is like the perfect example. Show me. Show me what the downside is. And the only downside, people could say, well, it's going to cost more money. That's the only downside. And if you flip that around, what it means is like, we don't want to collectively make sure kids get fed. That's what it really says. We'd rather keep what little, we want to keep our money. We don't want our money to go to anybody but our kids. And those kids, those parents who can't afford it, well, that's not our problem, right? That's how we live our lives in this country. It's horrific. So anyways, I just wanted to come back to that because it was really bothering me. It's just been really bothering me. And, you know, I mean, there's a couple other things that I just wanted to kind of touch on, but it's like the similar kind of, I don't know, maybe other people out there have a word for this, right? Maybe another way of kind of talking about this logic, right? Where instead of addressing root problems, right, we're willing to kind of like spend millions and millions of dollars policing people, determining people's eligibility to be part of like, you know, to get a lunch at school. We're willing to spend all sorts of money policing people. You know, and I remember, like, and I've told this story before. I mean, when we grow up, like, my parents got divorced, right? Like, and there was a period of time which we were pretty damn poor, right? My mom relied on food stamps and the generosity of neighbors to get us by on times. And I remember one of the worst parts about having to deal with any kind of social services, right? Is because you're navigating shame, right? It's like kind of like a gauntlet of shame, right? You're standing in line at the checkout of the grocery store, right? And you have to use food stamps. You have to deal with the shame of watching that kind of like uppity woman standing in front of us, like turn back and kind of look at us and kind of like, oh my God, right? I still remember that so vividly in my brain. Oh God, to this day. Right. So you deal with that kind of shame. Right. But then you also deal with the kind of like, you know, the cost of poverty. Right. You know, people who have written about this. Right. But in other words, so you go into, you have to find the time in your day. Right. to go and go down to the kind of government office to fill out all these forms so that they can judge whether or not you are actually deserving of the aid that you need. Right? And they're sitting there, they're kind of like, you know, looking at you, asking all these questions. And, you know, okay, look, maybe they're good people, maybe they're not good people. But they're sitting there, they're still going through, you're asking all these very personal questions. That if you were on the other side of that line, you would never have to answer for anybody. But as a condition to being able to get food for your kids, you have to kind of open up to strangers about intimate aspects of your life. Your privacy goes out the window. Right, so you're navigating, and it's everywhere, right? It's in like all these situations. You go to school, right? Some kids, oh, you got your kind of like fancy clothes on, and like you're sitting there, you're dealing kind of like hand-me-down tough skins, right? You know, like, I remember that, you know? And I remember some of the funniest times when I was in college, right? I remember like meeting other people, right? That have traveled similar roads, right? And we're sitting there, you know, because you can't get, you get to college and sit there and you're kind of supposedly on the same level as everyone else there, right? You're kind of admitted in the same college, but you know that kind of part of you, right? You feel like you're the big imposter there. You don't belong here, right? You have to fake it till you make it, right? And you come across some other people that kind of traveled a similar road, and it's like, it feels like relieving. And like, I remember some of the times I was laughing so hard at just sharing stories of like what it meant to kind of grow up on some of the freaking crap that we grew up on. So, you know, it's like these things, like where is that in our discussions? And you know, and I'll admit this, right? You know, I'll admit that, you know, I'm not sure how to have that conversation, right? Without the conversation itself being divisive. I think that, you know, I think one of the strengths I have in the world is also one that has some downfalls to it, right? You know, I tend to be, when I see a problem, I tend to like speak out about it, right? And I tend to kind of like get frustrated when we kind of repeat the same problem over and over again and pretend that we didn't resolve this before, you know, like, and then when someone is like, you know, in the face of just injustice, I cannot believe that people just were like, oh, I guess there's nothing we can do about it. And that gets me frustrated. And I don't hide my emotions very well. And so things like that. And I, the last thing in the world that I want to be, right, especially when you think about, you know, these schools and all this kind of stuff, or in this community that has just fought back to make this huge win, is to kind of like, you know, break apart a coalition, right? You know, that's the last thing in the world. But there's got to be a way to have a better conversation about so many things, right? Hey, you know, I've been focused on education here, but like here, just another example, right? So this is the other thing. There's this article in the Washington Post, right? Just from this morning. It says, Democrats spar over resignation as worries. What? Democrats spar over registration as worries over young and minority voters grow. And that says the rise of the Trump support among non-registered voters has run up against a long-held Democratic policy priority of growing the voters in the polls. Right. So the idea is that for the longest time, right, you know, you see like Democrats are really good in getting out the vote, right? Or that's what they wanted, to get more people registered, right? So here, in recent years, however, there has been a marked shift among the roughly 1 in 5 citizens of voting age who are unregistered toward Republicans, raising fresh questions about how much boosting nonpartisan voter registration could help presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump heading into November. Aaron Strauss, an influential data scientist who helps direct progressive spending at the firm Open Labs, sparked private disagreements over this issue in January. He sent about a dozen major Democratic donors a confidential memo that challenged traditional nonpartisan registration, right? In other words, normally it was like, you just go out, you want to register people to vote, right? You're not trying to, you're just, anybody's going to vote, like, you don't care. You're just going to register people, right? It says, quote, Quote, indeed, if we were to blindly register non-voters and get them on the rolls, we would be distinctly aiding Trump's quest for a personal dictatorship, Strauss argued in the memo, which was obtained by the Washington Post and cited recent polling that showed Trump's strength among unregistered voters. He also warned that efforts to gain Democratic votes among younger and non-Black people of color were often expensive, costing more than $1,200 per net vote in 2020, by one estimate, because the groups now include so many non-Democrats. Among voters of color, he wrote, that only, quote, only African-American registration is clearly a prime opportunity, unquote, adding that netting Democratic voters among Black people cost approximately $575 per vote in 2020. He called on donors to nonpartisan nonprofits to also donate to political groups that focus voter registration spending on specific heavily pro-Biden populations, unquote, like Black Americans, while using more targeted techniques among other groups to filter out likely Trump supporters. Campaigns, parties, or super PACs are more directly target who they can more directly target who they try to register. They frequently hire canvassers who wear candidate or issue focused clothing. Blah 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 blah. So okay. There's so much that I find kind of completely messed up about this, but like on the one hand, like same kind of stuff, right? Say it's the same kind of argument I have with myself in my own head. It's like, on the one hand, I don't want to see Trump in the White House again. So like gloves are off, man. We got to make sure that this guy gets defeated. Right. So that's number one. And what that person said, right, in that analysis, right, is not exactly wrong, right? It says, look, it's true. If you think you have resources, right, if you have resources that you want to make sure that you're going to kind of maximize the opportunity for your candidate to win, right, well, then you want to make sure that you're targeting those resources in ways that are not going to aid your opponent, right? Okay, I get that, logically speaking, right? But here's the issue. The issue is, even they talk about cost per vote, right? $1,200 per vote in 2020. But if you have Black people, you can kind of get them to vote for, you know, about $575 to vote and things like this. Aside from like putting people into kind of cost accounting spreadsheets, which is disturbing enough in my brain, but you know, whatever it is, again, I understand where they're coming from. But as bad as that is, right, it's like you're missing the forest through the trees here, right? And I understand like we're kind of in a crisis moment because it's an election year and all this kind of stuff, but where the hell are the folks who are saying like, okay, well, one, if we're only targeting certain groups of people, we're going to write off a whole bunch of other people. Well, I guess we're going to throw out the Democratic project. Right. There's a hidden recognition. Right. That democracy is failing in this whole kind of discussion in this article in Washington Post. It's like, there is nothing else but division. So all we're going to do is deepen the divide, deepen that kind of stuff. We're not going to kind of reach out. And at the same time, there's the big glaring question about, I wonder why young people are starting to favor Trump. Remember when, in 2020, the last presidential election, how did Democrats talk about Donald Trump and why we need to defeat him? Well, because he's an existential threat, right? That they turned him into some demon lord, right? And look, the guy was horrific. Did horrible things. Helped deepen the divide, all that kind of stuff. All right. But there's also this other part of it, right? Is that, well, okay, there's a whole bunch of people that normally voted for Democrats who basically bailed. What is it that Democrats are doing that are making them less popular? That's a great question. That's a great question. And if you respect people in the world, if you respect actually people in the world, that's an important question. If you think people are just dupes and they follow whatever charismatic leader comes next, well, then guess what? Then you've given up on the democratic process and you could do this kind of crap. The failure, and again, look, it's not sexy. It's not kind of interesting. It's not whatever to a lot of people. When by a lot of people, I mean people in the news business, people in official Democratic Party politics. But if you're going to be serious about kind of building back up a democratic culture, then you've got to invest in those things that are necessary for a democratic culture. And I mean things like education, like infrastructure, like a sustainable future that deals with facts, like about what we've done to our planet. You've got to support everyone's right to have access to the public sphere and create policies of inclusion, not exclusion. So when we look down at kind of like at, you know, Joe Biden going down to the border and having these warring press conferences with Donald Trump about who was going to be worse to immigrants, whose policy is going to reject the most amount of people. I mean, I just didn't even know what that would do with it. I was like, are you kidding me? Basically, what you're doing is you're telling everybody there is no difference. That both of us don't want immigrants. Right? It's effectively the same message, because you've got all these kind of like highly paid consultants in the Democratic Party that just won't seem to leave, who really think that the way that you play politics the best for the long haul is that you just sound more like your opponent to make people not be able to tell the difference between the two. And then you just act nicer. You act more like a guy you'd want to have a beer with. That kind of whole narrative. I mean, it's like, it's comical if you think about it. But you got to run on value. You got to run on values that are consistent. You got to run on things that are people going to matter. This is why, like, whole like Fetterman's thing of kind of like defecting to become like, you know, the next Joe Manchin now, it appears. Selling out all those people that got him elected to begin with. Because he's drank some Kool-Aid somewhere. The baby says, yeah, this is what you're going to win. Yep. You just move to this like middle, which really means not middle. It means like pro-corporate, anti-worker, racist, center. Right now, I'm not saying what's in his heart about that. I'm talking about the policies. I mean, you support a policy that's going to commit genocide against the Palestinian people. I don't know what you call that. You're pro-genocide? Is that what you're telling me? Anyways. So I don't know. I guess these are some of the kind of, you know, the discussions I have. And then on the other side, and I'll just mention this briefly, and then I got to get out of here tonight. I mean, there's an article in NPR. I'm sorry, this is New York Times. There was also one in the NPR, but this in New York Times. There's about the direction that Donald Trump is taking in his rallies, right? And what it is to more comfortably don the fascist framework. Strong leader linked to religion. So let me just read a little bit of this piece from the New York Times. This is from Michael Bender. Article's titled The Church of Trump, How He's Infusing Christianity into His Movement. As long known for his improvised and volatile stage performances, former President Donald Trump now tends to finish his rallies on a solemn note. Soft, reflective music fills the venue as a hush falls over the crowd. Mr. Trump turns reverent and somber, prompting some supporters to bow their heads or close their eyes. Others raise open palms in the air and murmur as if in prayer. In this moment, Mr. Trump's audience is his congregation and the former president, their pastor, as he delivers a roughly 15-minute finale that evokes the evangelical altar call, an emotional tradition that concludes some Christian services in which attendees come forward to commit to their Savior. Quote, "The great silent majority is rising like never before, and under our leadership, he recites from a teleprompter in a typical version of the script. We will pray to God for our strength and for our liberty. We will pray to God and we will pray with God. We are one movement, one people, one family, one glorious nation under God. The meditative ritual might appear incongruent with a raucous epicenter of the nation's conservative movement, but Mr. Trump's political creed stands as one of the starkest examples of his effort to transform the Republican Party into a kind of Church of Trump. His insistence on absolute devotion and fealty can be seen at every level of the party, from Congress to the Republican National Committee to rank and file voters. A little bit further down the article, the Trumpian flock is more likely to describe him, Trump, as a modern version of Old Testament heroes like Cyrus or David, morally flawed figures handpicked by God to lead profound missions aimed at achieving overdue justice or resisting existential evil. Quote, he is definitely chosen by God, said Marie Zier, a commercial real estate broker from Long Island who attended the Conservative Political Action Conference in February outside Washington, D.C. Quote, he's still surviving, even though all these people are coming after him. And I don't know how else to explain that other than divine intervention. Right? I mean, there's no question, right? We're talking about Christian nationalism is just kind of like, that is what is on offer from the Republican Party. That's it. I did have a good easier. Thank you, PJF. Just as an independent, I've noticed, PJF says, I've noted right-wing influencers online are more open to discussion with the other side. I think that could be a big contributor, potentially. I think that, one of the things that often happens, right, is that depends on who you're talking about, of course, right? Because you have some... I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think that, again, there's reason. When you've got a whole bunch of money, right, behind being able to pour into a kind of ideological project like they do on the right, right, you can basically set up people much easier to do that, right? Basically to have kind of, of these kind of stuff. But I would also say that, you have lots of folks on the right who are the debate boys, right? Which really, it's not about discussion or kind of open up or kind of understanding. It's about just kind of like, okay, we're going to go argument of point warfare. I'll see who can win this argument. Right. And I think, that's just as destructive as anything else, but there's a point taken in the sense that, it becomes absolutely critical. I think that, that we have these conversations and, again, I hate to bring everything back to Penridge School District, but one of the remarkable things I think about the enormous victory in the Penridge schools, right, about kind of overturning the, this kind of extremist board, those Moms for Liberty board, and kind of bringing kind of like, some sanity back to the district, was the kind of thing that you're talking about, the kind of thing about saying, but discussed with open the other side. When people went campaigning, right, when they went door to door, knocked on doors of people all across the district, they didn't just go look for, like in that article, they didn't just go look for just who are the Democrats, right, or who they think might agree with them. They talked to everybody, and they listened, and they had conversations. They talked about their experiences. They talked about the exchange like this. And frankly, I think that's the way most communities are. But, as our society has been ripped apart in terms of having social spaces where we can actually kind of engage, where we can actually kind of build these sustainable long-term arguments or discussions, really, have some sort of shared sense that we're in a community together and we might disagree with it. We can talk about it. And we can listen to each other. So we're not enemies, right? We'll see. I mean, I think that it's... I don't know. I mean, we're at a dangerous time, right? And I think that the solution to this, I always, come back to this idea about we have to do things Yeah, you know, you're right. It's about politics, much more about identity. But identity is, you know, is a funny thing. You know, this is also, identity is a funny thing when you're talking about politics, because, you know, it's funny. I teach this class and it's, you know, I'm sorry, I'm responding to, you know, PJF. I was also another comment here. So politics, about politics and much more about identity is like, we teach this class on, you know, rhetoric, democracy, and advocacy. And we read this book, Patricia Roberts Miller, it's called Demagoguery and Democracy, right? Kind of breaks down kind of what it means to live in a culture of demagoguery. And I'm not talking about like having a demagogue or having, but in a culture in which gets split up, right? In which, say, having a sense of reality or shared experience or deliberation or trying to solve problems together gets split off into these kind of identitarian movements. What I mean by that, the identity is not over like me as a white guy, not like that, but in other words, about talking about us versus them. So on the one hand, you might find out that there's experiences on some of these right-wing influencers that you're talking about that talk about, say, some sense of identity, but also know that that idea about belonging, about an us versus them, is also one of the chief ways in which democracy dies. If the way I talk about it on this show over and over again is like, look, if you are going to commit to a political project which is about team sports, right? That I'm just on this team and my goal is either to kind of like convince that person to be on my team or to defeat the destroy the other team. Right? Because my identity is my team. Right? And everybody else who's not on my team must be bad. That's a huge problem. So I find, you know, look, as someone who teaches, you know, I've taught now in higher education since like about, if I include my grad school years, you know, you can go back to kind of like the mid 90s, right? I've been at Kutztown University since 2002. And one of the things, you know, I remember early on in my career, and I've told this story before, but early on in my career, when I was first coming to teach in this area, like I'm not from Pennsylvania, I'm originally from kind of upstate New York. I lived in Ohio for a while. I lived in Washington, D.C. for a bit. And then I kind of moved up here when I got my job at Kutztown. And I would always hear these things about that would characterize the way things are, the kind of, you know, communities there. I was like, really conservative, really that. And I'm like, how can you like label everybody in that way, right? I mean, well, who are they, right? I mean, what are their families like? What are they kind of come out of, right? That's a much more interesting discussion than try to kind of put people in categories ahead of time. So in any case, I got to get out of here, folks. Appreciate everyone stop by tonight. PJF, good to see you on here. Glad to have you kind of aboard. Thanks for throwing some comments in. And I'll you know, this here, it says, PGF, I'll give you the last word here. Say humans are inherently tribal by nature. I'm not sure if I agree with you on that. That's why is this happening? Young people also see modern society starting to really not work, and we find comfort in other people that think like us. I totally agree. I mean, I would put that a little bit different rather than tribal in nature. I would say that, you know, community and kind of sense of connectiveness is something that is human, right? And when we start to feel that connectedness break down, right, then we look to things that give us that sense of belonging. And there's as much possibility as danger as there is in that. It's open for the kind of, you know, the tyrant and the demagogue to be going to make use of that for really horrible ends by blaming other people and damaging other people. But there's also the possibility of saying, hey, let's look at ways that we can bring everybody together. Yeah, I agree. That's great. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for the comments. Thanks for the discussion, everybody, tonight. I really appreciate your time and everything. And as always, you know, look, you can help support this show. You know, if you're watching on YouTube, you're kind of checking it out, make sure you like this program, make sure you share it and subscribe to the show. Look, you subscribe to the show, it helps other people find the show, right? It's been fantastic. And you know, you can do whatever you can, let other people know about it, bring them back to the show kind of every Monday at 7 o'clock. Fridays, we do our Friday politics roundup. And look, if you can support the show, please do. You can head on over to patreon.com/allrcpress. You can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Help us out. Help spread the word. Share us on social media, everybody. Have a great one. We'll see you later in the week. See ya!
I guess I'm glad I'm here.